Why are so many dogs suffering from health issues? Actress Katherine Heigl, who's helped save over 16,000 dogs through her foundation, says she's seeing more issues with dogs' joints, odors, and health than ever before. And after doing a ton of research, she feels there's one place we can look to support any dog's health: their food. So she decided to create something she could actually feel good about feeding her dogs. It's called Superfood Complete. Superfood Complete is made with over 30 of the healthiest ingredients on the planet, including several superfoods vital to your dog's health. Badlands Ranch also sponsors the Jason Debus Heigl Foundation, which has helped rescue thousands of dogs and place them in loving homes. Dogs across America are trying this food and experiencing amazing health benefits. Go to badlandsranch.com/save50 and order right now to get up to 50% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. If you want your dog to experience all these incredible things, go to badlandsranch.com/save50 today.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the Latin American History Podcast, episode 105, The Last Maya Kingdom. Before starting today, I just wanted to quickly mention that the first of the new monthly Friends of the Podcast episodes has been released today. Inspired by the recent episode on Machu Picchu, as well as partially by this one, it takes a look at one of the most important indigenous societies of the Andean region, Tiwanaku. Despite being one of the grandest and most important civilizations in the history of the Americas, very little was known about it and how its society functioned. We did touch on it way back in those early episodes on the pre-conquest Americas, but I thought it deserved an episode of its own. So if you're interested in signing up and getting access to this, as well as all future episodes, for $2 a month, there's a link in the description of this episode with information about how to do so. Now on to today's episode. Imagine your homeland has been invaded by a foreign power, one with a very different culture, religion, and way of organizing society. They start rearranging the government of your land and its people. And of course, this puts them at the top of the social scale, you towards the bottom. How do you respond to this? The most obvious option is to accept it, to decide that you lack the means to change the new order, even if you don't like it. You could choose to fight, to beat the newcomers and restore things to the way they were. But this also relies on having those means, otherwise it will just make things worse. Today's episode is about the Maya world, particularly the Yucatan, and if you've listened to the mini-series we did on the conquest of the Yucatan, you will know that it was very difficult for Spain to take control of the area. The people there did resist for a very long time. They will continue to for centuries through uprisings. At the point we reached at the end of that series, that initial phase of war against the invasion was finished. The Maya leaders had concluded that it was no longer viable to conduct that kind of campaign. So that leaves you with a third option, one taken much less often, as it involves such upheaval. It also requires that the conquering society is unable to prevent you taking it. You can choose to leave and find somewhere else to transplant your society. Individuals or family groups often take this path, becoming refugees from conflict. But to uproot a whole society, a whole state, is much less common. most of the Maya city-states of the Yucatan Peninsula chose the first option, punctuated by those uprisings I mentioned a moment ago. But at least one didn't. It chose to move. Perhaps the most famous Maya site amongst a whole collection of spectacular candidates is Chichen Itza, Chichen Itza, as it's usually pronounced in English. This is as much due to its location, close to the resorts of the Yucatan, as it is to anything else. But there is no question that it is an important place. The name means something like place at the mouth of the well of the Itza. The Itza bit is not translated, because it is the name of the people who built it and who lived there. There is another place with the word Itza in its name, Lake Peten Itza in Guatemala. This lake is peppered with Maya ruins, many of which are yet to be properly excavated. It doesn't have an awe-inspiring, standout historic feature like the Great Pyramid at Chichen Itza, but I would argue that it's no less spectacular in its own way. The lake itself is beautiful, tranquil and surrounded by tropical greenery, its waters clear. The city of Flores sits on the shore. It's not a large city, but it is the administrative capital of Petén, the vast and relatively empty northern region of Guatemala, which ecologically is really an inland extension of the Yucatan Peninsula. Culturally, the two are linked as well. Much of Petén's population is Maya, and this includes the descendants of the Itza, who migrated at the time of the conquest. The city itself is nice enough. It has a ramshackle market, which if you wander around, will really make you feel like you're experiencing some genuine local culture. It's the historic centre, though, which is the main attraction. It's pretty small. It has no space to expand, because it's built on an island in the lake. Today it's linked to the rest of the city by an artificial causeway, but this is a relatively recent addition. The Spanish colonial buildings are extremely charismatic. They're not built from stone, but mostly from wood, giving them a different look to the other colonial towns in Latin America. They are painted bright colours, and they stagger up the slopes of the hill. The island is the shape of a cone, connected by a small warren of alleys and steps. The waterfront which runs around it is extremely pleasant, and the sunsets over the lake which you can view from it are spectacular. Flores means flowers, and my last visit there happened to coincide with the town's annual festival. Generations of families sat together at long tables in the evenings, weaving flowers into elaborate decorations to be used for the festivities. They did this on the waterfront, playing music and laughing together. Everyone seemed to be having a great time. You can probably tell, I like Flores a lot. Now, this is the name which the Spanish gave it, but the original one is Nox Peten. When the Itza made the decision to leave their homeland in response to the conquest, it was on this island that they made their new home. Presumably they hoped that they could live there unmolested forever. This didn't happen, of course, but it did win them 175 years, meaning that they were among the last of Latin America's indigenous peoples to be conquered. It would be nice and neat from a storytelling perspective if the migration I have described took place in one wave. History is rarely that simple, however, and the movement of the Itza is murky and not well understood. It's possible that their initial migration to Petén may have actually been in response to conquest or attacks by neighbouring Maya groups, just prior to the arrival of the Spanish. When Hernán Cortés had finished conquering the Aztec, he did make a journey southwards to Central America as he sought to incorporate that area into his viceroyalty. He is said to have stopped at the lake and spent a few days with the Itza. This happened in 1525, so before the Montejo family even began their long drawn-out conquest of the Yucatan. as we shall see later in the episode, some of the Itsar may have been living on the lake all along. Either some of them moved south before the arrival of the Spanish, whether Cortes met with a different group of Itsar who had always lived there, or whether there was some sort of mistake and the two groups were not connected. It does seem that the Itsar who remained in the area around Chichen Itza were displaced by the Spanish conquest and did uproot their society to move down there. There isn't really much of Nokpiten left, the Itzar capital built on the island. Flores was, of course, constructed right on top of it. The ruins on other parts of the lake do survive, however. One day when I was last there, we took a boat across the narrow bit of lake which separates the island from a peninsula. We decided to walk across the ridge of that peninsula down to a small beach on the other side. We followed a path into the woods, which weaved around some suspiciously man-made looking mounds. Groups of monkeys screamed from the branches above, staring down at us angrily for disturbing their peace. Soon my suspicions were confirmed. We came to a clearing, where a sign told us that we were in the main plaza of what was once the Maya settlement of Tayasal. I'd had no idea that this place even existed. It was stelae, and a set of steps leading up what looked like a steep grassy mound, that was in fact the main pyramid. It was tranquil, walking round the site. Far from being shuffled between restored ruins alongside busloads of other visitors, we were the only ones there. There hasn't been much work done at the site, so there isn't much to see. It is mainly just these grass-covered mounds with trees growing out of them. This did give it an exciting feel, though, like walking through a lost and unknown city. We know that the site was occupied throughout the Maya period, unlike Nokpiten, which appears to have been chosen by the Itzar after their migration from the Yucatan. This place was lived in for centuries. It doesn't appear to have been particularly powerful, however. It was repurposed by the Itzar, and when Cortes visited it, he said it was used for religious rituals.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger for thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger for thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
People are driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. The hiring process can be slow and overwhelming. Simplify hiring with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. Listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ12. That's Indeed.com/PODKATZ12. Terms and conditions apply.
This is just one of many Maya sites around the lake. They are all interesting for different reasons. Immediately across from Tayasal, on another small peninsula, is Nishtun Chich. This site dates back to the early days of Maya culture, before the heights of the classical period, when cities were just starting to form, and before the most famous ruins and pyramids were built. although there were always variations between cities. By that classical period, the Maya had settled on a distinct way of organizing their societies and cities. It seemed that the rulers of Nishtunchich, in this early period before the culture had solidified, were experimenting with different ideas. Their city was a planned one, built on a grid system, something which archaeologists theorize may have been a way of initially establishing control over the population. It didn't catch on, and so the site is an anomaly. Grids only returned with the Spanish. I didn't make it there, but it offers a fascinating glimpse of the early formative part of Maya history, when the culture was still developing. Clearly, even then, the rulers had a great deal of power, as they were able to plan out their city and to marshal the population to build it. At the far end of the lake is Ixlu. Now, I have only just discovered this during the research for this episode, but like Nok Peten, this city was, at its height, much later than most Maya settlements. It seems that another group, the Kowo, may have come down from the Yucatan like the Itza, and built another state independent of the Spanish. Free from outside interference, the two groups may have continued the classic Maya tradition of fighting each other in the decades between their migration and the final arrival of the Spanish. Their capital was on another nearby lake, and Ixlu may have been fought over by the two groups. Ixlu's most notable feature is an altar, with some very well-preserved glyphic writing. Finally, on the north side of the lake is Motul. Motul was occupied continuously from the early Maya period until the end of the classical. It is fairly big, but it was never one of the great powers. It was at various points under the control and influence of larger neighbourhoods like the famous Tikal, not too far away, and also in Guatemala's Petén, Calakmul and Yaxchilan. What makes Motul interesting is its potential link to the Itza. I said earlier that history is not usually neat, and not as amenable to telling in a simple story as a podcaster might like. This is especially true when the archaeological and historic evidence is unclear. Chichen Itza was built relatively late in the classical period, the time when Maya civilizations were at their height. We don't know that much about what is often called the Maya collapse, when these cities started to go into decline, and the Maya seemed to have reorganized themselves into smaller polities. There is some evidence that, possibly connected to whatever was causing these changes, some Maya may have migrated northwards to the Yucatan from Petén. There is writing in Motul which refers to a king of the Itza, and so there is a theory that the Itza may have actually been based here for most of their history, moved up to Chichen Itza and built a much grander and more powerful city, and then declined, moving back to northern Guatemala in response to the Spanish invasion. Whatever the case, and despite conflicts with neighbours, between Cortés' visit and the final conquest of Nok Peten, Itza society seems to have been fairly stable, and they were able to live more or less as they had before the migration. We know from the names of their rulers that they had a stable, ruling dynasty. It seems that the rulers, as well as the elites of the city, made sure that they had heirs to inherit by practicing polygamy, although the common classes didn't. Many Maya states after the Great Collapse were ruled in decentralized ways, as confederations of cities, for example. It's hard to know for sure, but it appears that the Itza stuck to a more old-fashioned system, where a strong ruler reigned in a fixed capital, Nok Peten. As is seen across the indigenous American world, great religious emphasis was put onto the four cardinal directions, and, as elsewhere, this translated into the political system. Nok Peten was the center of the Itza state, but, using English language terminology, there were probably four governors who were in charge of the day-to-day running of each section. These were not equal, however. They varied in size, and the west was the most important section, with the largest population. It was also here that the ruling family had their origins. These governors were assisted by vice governors, and together these eight, along with 13 other nobles and the Itzaz highest priest, formed a council which advised the ruler. The Maya had different ways of categorizing family to our own. Importance was placed on a person's father's brother's son. What is to us just one of our cousins, but to the Itza, was seen as a sort of extension of the ruler himself. It was this cousin slash second half of the body of the ruler who served as the high priest. We don't know how many people lived within the Itza state. The only estimates we have come from Spaniards, who were often vague and at the time of writing had seen almost nothing of the region. There were probably at least 40 small towns under their control, however, and it was in these urban centres, rather than villages or on remote farms, that they preferred to live. They expanded the territory under their control in the years between the migration and the arrival of the Spanish. This may have been a strategy to protect themselves against the Europeans. It gave them a buffer zone of non-Itza Maya, who the Spanish would have to get through before they could approach Nocpiten. Spanish control could be tenuous even in the parts of the Maya world which they had conquered, and so by expanding their influence towards these fringes, the Itza could attempt to persuade conquered Maya people to resist. There was a minor rebellion around where the border of Mexico and Belize is today, and according to one Spanish source, there were probably Itza people involved in the confrontation, even though it was another group's land and people rebelling. Although they expanded, conquered, and built new towns, Nocpiten was always their grandest city. The lake rose in the 1980s, and so before then, and therefore during the time when it was Nocpiten, the island of Flores would have had another ring of houses at the waterfront, which have now been submerged. In the middle, on top of the hill, were the temples and the houses of the ruling council and nobility. Spanish descriptions make it sound quite like Flores appears today, a densely packed warren crammed into all available space. Fascinatingly, the layout of the Spanish town, even today, may reflect the layout of the Itza city. Like the wider state, it too was probably divided according to the four cardinal directions, and it is speculated that four of the larger roads leading up to the top of the hill may have been dividing lines between these sections. The Spanish conquerors described tall temples rising from the island, one of which may have been modelled on the pyramid at Chichen Itza, although not on the same scale. It seems, then, that the Itza had established a prosperous state, although it wasn't as powerful as the one they had left behind. This state of affairs couldn't continue forever, though. Not while Paten and the Itza were encircled by the Spanish Empire, and hungry governors looked for ways to enhance their fame. Next episode, we will tell the story of the conquest of Nocpiten. It was far from easy, and it required some inventive strategies. If you've enjoyed today's episode and you feel like doing something to help out, one thing you can do is leave a review wherever you get your podcast from. It really helps the podcast grow, as it allows new people to discover it. If you're feeling extremely generous, it is also possible to make a one-off donation. There's information about how to do both these things in the episode description. A huge thank you to everyone who's done any of these things to support the podcast. And thank you to everyone for listening. You've been listening to the Latin American History Podcast. Written and produced by me, Max Argent. Edited by Alex McNamara. If you want to become a friend of the podcast and gain access to a bonus episode each month, as well as helping to support the running of the show, there's a link with information about how to do this in the episode description. The podcast can also be found on Facebook and Twitter by searching for the Latin American History Podcast. here, I post updates about new episodes, as well as interesting articles I find about Latin American history. Thank you for listening.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.